Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. The good thing is the clouds are gone, the sun is shining, and it's freezing outside. It's about 48 degrees, but we don't care. When I get done, you're going to be as hot as the people in the book that we're going to talk about, because Murder in Dog Bay deals with, on a hot, sweltering summer day, reporter, and I like this character, Olivia Kerr, and her husband, Jerry, invite Olivia's colleague, Dale Colby, and his family to the beach. Accompanying them is a very pregnant Maggie Ryan, Jerry's sister, and her family. At the last minute, Dale decides not to show up. Oh, he should have, because he winds up dead. Poor thing. Oh, well, too bad. Vietnam veteran turned police officer, I like this character, by the way, Holly Schweiner leads the investigation, battling Maggie and demons of her own. That is book one. We have a double header today, people, and you are going to go crazy because this book is really one of my favorites, Murder and Misread. And this case is my favorite topic, reading. Statistician Maggie Ryan returns to her alma mater to consult for Professor Charlie Fielding. I really liked him, though, in spite, you know. He was conducting experiments on how skilled readers read. This is what really caught my interest, because that's important. She's invited to a celebratory luncheon with retired Professor Tal Chandler. Unfortunately, somebody didn't like him because he's dead. Too bad. The police say suicide, but she knows it's not. And who killed him? I'm not going to tell you. Welcome to the show, P.L. Carson. Hi, good morning. How are you? This is really exciting, doing two books in one show. This is fantastic. How are you?
I'm fine. And the weather's about the same here as where you are.
Oh, it's beautiful outside. I took a walk before the show because I have to clear my head. And it's so much fun just to walk. And I said, oh, my God, it's freezing out here. It's great. So
yeah.
In both novels, I'm going to alternate people between one novel, both novels, and I'm going to start with Murder in Dog Days first because that's what I have in front of me. Within both novels, you introduced statistician Maggie Ryan. How did you create this character? And I really like her. She makes some of the police department look really bad. She's smart.
Yes, she is. When I first decided to write a mystery, I thought, what would the most unlikely detective be? Because I knew that it was supposed to be, you know, like a opium addict in a deerstalker hat, or a little lady in an English town that everybody ignored until she solved the crimes. Mm-hmm. And all of those traditional things were rather unlikely, and it was always better if the detective was an unlikely person. And at that time, this was in the 70s, 80s, I was trying to think who was the least likely to be able to solve a crime. And from my own experience, I realized it would be a mother with toddlers, because a mother with toddlers has zero time. and it seemed this would be a great detective, but then I started thinking, she would probably be a bad mother if she dropped everything to go and solve crimes. Why would a woman be so motivated to find out who the murderer was when she had little kids that depended on her so much? And so I started much earlier than the mother with toddlers that really inspired me. I went back to when Maggie Ryan was in college and how she solved one crime. It was a backstage murder because my husband happens to be in the theater, and I spend a lot of time backstage during our early years together. She moved on, and I realized very soon that what I was really doing was looking back. Since I was a mother with toddlers myself, I was looking back at all the things that I'd missed. I knew things were happening in the world in the late 60s and 70s, but I had these little kids to take care of. And so I sort of used Maggie as a way to get back and explain my own history and what had happened to the world while I was busy changing diapers and so forth. And it was kind of nice. It was a tour guide through my own recent history, and I enjoyed it very much. And Maggie was a good person to go with because she was bright and curious and was going to come out as this occasionally pushy young woman who was always ready to go solve a murder.
Oh, she was. She definitely doesn't back down, which is my kind of person, because I don't back down either. When I want to know mm-hmm. something, I'm going to do it. Even if you don't want me to know the answer, I'm going to ask the question anyway. So
good.
she's really good. And when it comes to solving the murders, how come the police warn her in both books to help? I mean, she's more like, she's not as annoying as some of the other females. Like, and we have Jessica Fletcher, who's okay. My favorite, of course, is Hedy Winthrop. I love her.
Oh,
Patricia Rutledge.
Yes, she's fun.
She's fun, but sometimes you get annoyed with the Miss Marple and the rest of them. So what makes Maggie stand out that the police want her to help out in both books?
Well, I'm not sure the police actually want her to. She's very good at talking to people. She's mm-hmm. curious, which I approve of, and I imagine you approve of that too. And is always willing to see discrepancies and try to figure out what maybe really happened. My background is in psychology, in experimental psychology, and it's because I'm very interested in people also, so I didn't have any trouble with having Maggie be curious about what makes people tick, and why would they say such and such a thing, and why was somebody grabbing in their pocket for a pipe that wasn't there, and all kinds of things like that. So she's very observant, and I think it helps both in being a good mom and in being a good detective. I've always thought that mothers should be able to have adventures too. So this
I
is
totally,
one reason I wanted
I totally
to.
Agree.
Yeah, yeah.
I totally agree.
In so many of the earlier books, the mothers are there, but they are just kind of breaks, you know, always telling the detective, oh, you mustn't go there, that's dangerous, and so forth.
Yeah.
And even Nancy Drew, who was, you know, one of my childhood heroes, she didn't even have a mother on the scene. Nobody was going to tell her to stop. And so I think that's the only reason that she was able to solve crimes, because the traditional mom of you've got to be safe, you mustn't do anything dangerous, was not there. And so I wanted Maggie to be somebody who would be out there herself.
But also in the books, too, her little girl's there a lot, too. She doesn't just leave her behind. You know, she
mm-hmm.
takes her with her. You know that she's there. She's a cute little munchkin. Yeah. So this in the first book, we have Dale, and he decides, poor guy, not to go to the beach with his friends and family. And how does this result in his murder? Oh, too bad. Because when you get to know him, you might not care that he's dead. I mean, nobody should be dead, but you might not care. Once you get to know him, you'll say, well, okay, maybe. So how did how come he didn't go? Poor thing, he should have gone. Then again, they might have poisoned him on the beach. So it doesn't matter. So how did he set off the chain of events to result in murder? That was so cool.
Well,
you don't expect
Dale Colby was an investigative reporter, and he was always the one that they turned to at his little Virginia newspaper to do the really big jobs, and to because he was very methodical, very devoted to what he did. He was also a bit controlling at home, and not always the sweetest guy around, but Olivia, who is another character and also a reporter, admired him very much for the quality of his work. So when a plane crashed that a congressman was supposed to be on, this set off some questions. You know, was this just an accident, or was there a reason that this plane went down? And the congressman, of course, was very interested in what it was, but he felt that he was the target because he was supposed to be on that plane. And therefore, his assistant was on the plane. So it got political very quickly, and the congressman wouldn't, even though they decided it was an accident, the congressman was still investigating because he wanted to know who was out to get him. And so this was the reason that Dale Colby was the one at the newspaper who was assigned to this question, because Olivia, while she's a good reporter, was not very, you know, she was still a pretty green reporter. She had only started a year or so before. And the other man, the other reporter, Nate, was a good reporter, but was a bit lazy. So Dale was the one. Now, the reason he was at home was that he had Parkinson's. And at that time, they were just introducing a new drug, L-DOPA, and he was having the side effects that usually come along at the beginning of, well, probably most new drugs, while they try to decide exactly what the perfect dosage is. He was nauseous and just couldn't quite you know, get around as well, and sometimes he had too much and sometimes he didn't have enough. But it was settling in and had improved many of his symptoms. So he was going to stay on it, but he still needed a few more days to get used to the proper dosage. That's why he was at home. And the that was not the reason he didn't go to the beach, though. He was planning on going to the beach with them, but he got a call about the big story before they were leaving and decided, all right, I'm going to stay here and finish this. This is more important. He was that kind of dedicated person.
Well, maybe if he wasn't so dedicated, he would have not been dead. But then again, you don't know that.
Yes, yes. It did mean he was left alone for a long time.
This is true. So they had no idea when they were having fun that they would come back and find a dead body. That's always cool. It's different. So we have Olivia Kerr, and she's really interesting. She's an interesting reporter, and she gets involved also. So how do they, when they return home from the beach, and Donna Colby, his wife, learns that her husband has been murdered, what is strange about the way she reacted? Because it's, you know, usually you go, oh, my God, whatever. She didn't seem to react that way.
Well, she was quite stunned. She comes in, and after you know, after they discover the place is locked, it takes them a while to get the office opened because it's locked from the inside. And Donna is just stunned at what she sees there. Her husband with blood all over his head and lying in this awkward position. She's just quite astonished at the scene, and I think many people are. She, in Donna's case, I think she's been used to being sort of that he was the one who directed the family. It was very much a male-run family whenever he was around, and suddenly there's this center of her life that unexpectedly is lying there very bloody, and I think it takes her a little while to get over it. She keeps asking, you know, what happened? How could anyone get in there and then get out again? And that's a question that I hope the readers are asking too, because they find him inside his office with the door locked on the inside and nobody else is there.
Well, we're not going to tell them how it happens because they're going to have to read the book to find out. And I guarantee they won't figure it out. We're not going to tell them. Because this is so clever, I go like, oh, my God, really? So we have both Olivia and Nate. Now, I know that from remembering that Dale was not very nice to his children, too. And God help them if they didn't do the right thing. And if she didn't have dinner on the table, he wasn't very nice. At which point I would have told them to call go into McDonald's or call takeout, and that would have been the end of that.
So I know.
Olivia,
this guy would not have done it all for you or me. But I think it was very common at the time. The women's movement was still in process. Maggie was part of that. And I think that many people like Donna just thought, well, I'm supposed to be the servant and take care of the family and so forth. And so she had her priorities and just sort of sucked it up whenever Dale was over the head. The other thing, at the particular time we meet Dale, is that he's home And instead of working at the office where he often does, he's in his home office because of the illness, because of getting used to the new drug. And therefore, he's more likely to be annoyed by the sounds that the children make and so forth. And they're 9 and 12 and very into music and things like that. So there are lots of places that there could be conflict. And I remember the closest I ever came to child abuse was when my son was 2 and I was trying to write a thesis. And this was in the days of typewriters, not computers. And so every page you wrote had to be perfect. And I was working away at it, and he ate one of the pages, or tried to. So this was before I could get it copied or anything. So I thought, boy, you know, I can sympathize with Dale on that. It's when you're trying to get something done and focus on the phone call or focus on the computer or the typewriter in his case. It's just very difficult to have a little kid with, you know, however deserving the child might be, it's just not a good way to babysit at the same time. Especially with Dale's.
No, I agree. I had a computer, but unfortunately my professor, when I went for my reading master's, insisted that we use a typewriter to type your first paper. I thought,
God.
You had to type it not on paper. You had to type it on an index card, the back and the front. And,
wow.
Yeah.
That was kind of a mean professor.
He was tough. Yeah. And then you handed it in. It had to be not the small one, but the one above it. And I think I wrote up until the margin on the bottom and on the side. And I handed it in. And the next week I came in, and the person whose name was at before mine was always late. So I always got the first question, but I was wise because I figured somebody said, just make sure you have your notes in front of you and memorize them. And he embarrassed everybody. He told everybody their grades. He read them all out, all 30 of them. And I thought I was going to, oh, my God. And, you know, you got it between a 0 and a 10. And he walked in and he said, now that you've all typed this, and you couldn't have a mistake, you're right, and you couldn't use whiteout. And he said, now that you typed this, only 2 or 3 of you have a brain, and the rest of you are going to remedial writing. And these were teachers.
Oh, dear.
And I'm looking and going, God, holy God. And I was the one that got the 10, and I looked at him. I go, well, of course, I'm smart. What can I tell you? After that, I was in big trouble because he picked every one of my articles. He wouldn't let me pick for myself. And I and you try taking a 25-page article and putting it on one index card. And I said, I'll use as many as I want because you have to, because you picked. He didn't say a word. It's like, oh, my God. So, yeah. So,
well, good.
What can I say? Both Olivia and Nate want to get a job with a better paper. But Dale is given the prime assignment to look at the fatal plane crash. And obviously because he's so good at what he does, so they pick him and not them. So everyone is killed on the flight, but the owner of the plane decided, like Dale didn't go to the beach. Well, the owner of the plane was smart. He didn't go. So
yes, that was the representative.
The representative. And so why doesn't he, you know, what odds does it make him that he's not a suspect in the plane crash? And his widow doesn't sound too unhappy either. Or is she that unhappy? No, some people just don't care.
Well, she's not a widow. The widow of one of the important donors is there, and she's officially unhappy. And it turns out that some of the people on the plane had other issues in their life, and so that's one of the things that, of course, has to be investigated. Was Dale getting too close to the truth? If he's asking the right questions, people will see that there might be a problem there. So this is the reason that people get interested in what exactly was going on in his investigation. There are two problems they have. One is, here's this guy bashed and bloody in this locked room, so they have to figure out how it was done, and they would also have to figure out why it was done, who hated him enough, what were the issues in Dale's life, and what was he finding out about this plane crash. So for somebody who's alone in a room, there are an awful lot of questions that still have to be answered.
Well, they're not going to find out from me. Because I don't think anybody's, you know, I've read close to 3,000 murder mysteries, maybe more. I lost count. And this is really unique. Because I'm saying, now, how in heaven blazes if she's going to get somebody to go in there that no one knows that he's in there? Well, we can't tell you how, but this was really smart. And you won't suspect who, so too bad. now, we've got the other character that I like a lot, and they need to get married. It's about time. Jerry Ryan is Olivia's boyfriend and a doctor, along with Donna Colby. Dale's wife and her two daughters, Tina and Josie, will join Olivia at the beach. I like Tina and Josie. I felt sorry for them that they got stuck with him and her father. Added in, we have his sister Maggie and her husband Nick. But Dale requests that Donna leave him his lunch. He needed to take a much-needed nap in order to get the story. So, but his nap is now, when you turn the page, his nap is now the events that inspired that story. So he's got this medicine, L-DOPA, that you said, adverse, whatever, and he's not aware even of his surroundings. So when someone comes in or tries to kill him, how does this affect him? I don't take medicine. I think I'd rather, I don't like taking pills like that, ever. I mean, the most thing I'll take is a Tylenol or Motrin. That's it. So what kind of adverse effects does this drug have? Yeah, that's horrible.
Well, actually, if you have Parkinson's, L-DOPA is much better if you take it, because it reestablishes a balance in your brain. So I think he was probably functioning much better with the L-DOPA than without it, but he still has to take his naps. This is, you know, part of getting used to it. I think the nap could keep him out of understanding exactly what was going on if the person were quiet who managed to sneak in somehow. But on the other hand, it wasn't a deep sleep. There's no reason that he would die. And so this is the reason everyone is so puzzled, and have somebody coming in and socking him on the head with the lamp is a very, very difficult question to solve. Or people, you know, you can visualize the murder, but it's impossible to figure out how the person then got out again. So there's somebody very clever at work here, and trying to figure out who it is the question. So, go ahead.
I'm surprised his kids didn't do it.
Well, the kids, and you'll notice that Maggie is very interested in the kids. Not that she thinks they did it, but that she's very interested in what they might have observed, in what exactly their relationship with the father was that might throw light on why he's dead. And so she, I think throughout the series, you see this a little bit in the next book also. Maggie is always very concerned with children, and particularly little girls, and how they are being treated by the adults. She wants them to have, well, I think all of us want this for our daughters. She wants them to have a very fulfilling kind of world where they can achieve what they need to achieve and be protected from things that they aren't old enough yet to deal with. And this is one of the things that makes her heart go out to Dale's two little girls. She knows that they are in a very tough situation now, with the father and breadwinner suddenly missing from the family. And so she's very concerned with making sure that they're doing all right, particularly the older one, Josie, because she's the one who seems to be withdrawing into herself. The younger one is crying and also relating to the other kids on the scene, Maggie's own daughter. So she seems to be having a more normal, open kind of grief. But Josie is just pulling into herself, and Maggie senses that there's a problem there. The mother, Donna, meanwhile, is very, very concerned just how did this happen? Where did all that blood come from? How did this?
Mm-hmm.
Why is their life suddenly upside down this way? And all of the police on the scene and so forth. I don't think that she really knows how to deal with any of this because she's had a rather sheltered life within the confines of her little cage.
Yeah, no, she seems like she's in a fog of her own and she needs some Prozac or something to calm her down. Or maybe
yeah.
she is on something and it's calming her down. But which brings to light something as an educator, is a child abuse. And
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have to be physical, but from what I gather, the father used to browbeat Josie a lot with, you know, her imperfections. And he used to do the same to Donna. And Josie never told her. And I'm surprised
mm-hmm.
that if a child, you know, when a child is a talkative kid in school and all of a sudden
mm-hmm.
becomes quiet, you got to find out why. And I've reported
mm-hmm.
child abuse quite a bit. Seriously.
Yes,
so,
yes.
And I was never wrong. So how come nobody picked up on it? And yet she never told her mother, or if she did, no one ever did anything about it, which makes it a very important issue in the story.
Yes, I think that's very true. And I think partly it was the time, because in the early 70s, we were just discovering that there was so much child abuse. It's the kind of thing that you keep secret because when you're a child, you think, well, maybe I am to blame. Maybe I really was making all that noise. And the other thing which causes conflict is that, of course, children love their parents. They depend on them. They do have good times with them. It's not that there aren't some good times too. It's just that beating a child, even psychologically, is a very, very cruel
mm-hmm.
thing to do because they're defenseless. They love you. It's just a very bad situation for the kid. And so I think that we are now much more aware of it. We do require teachers
mm-hmm.
to report the symptoms, but it wasn't there yet. This is still the 70s. Roe
mm-hmm.
v. Wade giving women the chance to not have a child in difficult circumstances was just a few years old at that point, a lot of things that women really fought for did not yet exist. So people like Donna were in a much worse situation than she would be today. And also today she would probably have much savvier friends who would say, look, you've got to get out of this kind of situation. You'll be better off on your own. And in fact, she did... I think rather weigh that because with Dale, the two of them together, she did have a teacher's salary. The two of them together were rather able to afford a nice house in a nice district and so forth. And often if you're single with only one salary, you're not able to do as well. And the question is he really that bad? And certainly in
mm-hmm.
the 70s, that would be the question. He was already...
That's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Yeah.
That's difficult, I know, because a lot of people say, well, you know, better than nobody, have somebody. And then you don't realize
mm-hmm.
better nobody than somebody that's going to take you down. Which it definitely had an impact on Josie. But before we get to her,
mm-hmm.
we have like three more questions on this book, because we got to get to the second one,
which is really
unbelievably... Detective Schweiner is thorough, smart, and sometimes too vulnerable when speaking with Maggie. He's no match for her, or she's no match, who seems to pry into the lives of everyone involved and hits a serious chord when she realizing that Holly Schweiner was in Vietnam, saw action. So how does this change things between them? Because Holly's a strong character, but yet she can't deal with the lives and deaths of the haunted memories. So why does Maggie, how does she sort of relate to Maggie on that?
I was interested in that. You probably noticed that the way I usually mm-hmm. write my mysteries is with two different point of view characters. One of the point of view characters is, of course, Olivia Kerr, the reporter, and the other one is Holly Schreiner. And it was kind of interesting because when I started this book, I thought there was going to be a male reporter and a different point of view character. And when I'd written a couple of chapters, suddenly this character came striding into my head and said, "I'm Holly Schreiner and this book is about me." And I said, "Yes, absolutely," and tore up what I'd written and started again. Holly is a character, I think that this was part of my working through what had happened while I was raising small kids. The Vietnam War had happened, and this loomed over me and my friends all through college and afterwards, and it continued to even after it was officially over, because we were just discovering post-traumatic stress and how this was affecting so many of the veterans. We were just discovering the kind of damage that thought that maybe the U.S. is not always right. After World War II, had been on the right side and felt pretty good about it. In Vietnam, things were much, much, much murkier. So there were many things that had changed because of that war. And I had just been reading around a little bit and realized that while the men were beginning to get a lot of attention for post-traumatic stress, there had been women there too. And they were nurses, and so, you know, they didn't fight, and therefore everything was A-OK with them. But when you think about it, they probably saw more people die than any individual male soldier who was out on the front line. He would lose his buddies, which was terrible. But the nurses had to deal with all of those people that came back, many of them alive, and try to save their lives. And they saved many of their lives, but there were deaths. And all of this was really, really difficult for somebody who went out to, you know, try to save the world the way Holly Schreiner, the young nurse, did. So when she came back and tried to explain to people, and this is something many nurses reported when they returned, first of all, nobody would take them seriously because they weren't supposed to be on the front lines, although many of them were so close that it didn't make any difference. They may not have shot anybody, but they dealt with people who had been shot. So she had these horrible memories, and nobody would say, "It's okay to feel bad about that." It was so she had to kind of draw into herself, as many of them did, and try to deal with it without having any tools, any friends, anything at all. What Holly did was turn and go to what her father had done, which was to be a cop. And this was a good way to kind of hide behind a mask and try to deal with, you know, try to make the world a slightly better place in a different way by dealing with the murders. So she's very committed to her job. It's kind of making it up. But on the other hand, all those memories she's been trying to keep in the background keep bursting through. You ask about how this affected her relationship with Maggie. And the answer is that the first time she sees Maggie, several things about Maggie physically remind her of bad memories. And Maggie is wearing a peace shirt. And so instantly Holly is thinking, "Oh, this is somebody who's just going to spit on my whole, you know, all of my history, being in that war and trying to take care of the soldiers and so forth." And so she starts out with these very negative feelings and is really struggling throughout the beginning to mash them down.
Well, before I forget, because I don't want to forget, and I have my list in front of me. Just because I'm going to be on the air Thursday with one of my favorite authors, the author of 37 Hours, Barry Kerwin is here. And on the 24th, the author of Bones to Pick. And on the 26th, Reese Hirsch, The Insider. And on the 30th, I am so pumped. The author of Thief's Mark, Carla Negers, will be here. And I've never do three shows in a week, but somehow I got roped into this. Lynn and Valerie Constantine will be here with The Last Mrs. Parrish. If you've seen it on Facebook, I got to read it before everybody else did. It's fantastic. And another New York Times author, David McAuliffe, will be here with Reload. Can anybody ask better than that? You can't, except for today. What can I say? This is, and if you want to know what book to read, I mean, it's almost time for Hanukkah, people. So why don't you just get online and buy all of her books? Make it so easy because you got to start from the beginning. And if you want to know what Fran is reading at the same time, J.A. Jams, Man Overboard, James Rowland, Demon Crown, Iris Johansson's new one, Mind Game, waiting to hear about an interview with her, Matt Dunn, Act of Betrayal, Cheryl's Listening, You Won't Put It Down Once You Start It, and Pound of Flesh by Alex Gray. I'm reading both of them at the same time and should be done with them by tomorrow, if not before. That's how good, they're serious, that's how good they are, and that's why I complain about my eyes. So let's go on to Murder, Miss Red. This deals with my favorite topic, reading in the whole world. This story takes place 2 years after the first one, with Maggie hired as a statistician when Professor Charles Fielding hires her to crunch the numbers in a research project based on, this is great, how skilled readers read. Describe this project and why is this the basis of the novel? Once I read that, that was it. I couldn't put it down. So how come you decided to do that? And what was the research you did into skilled readers? Because they consider me one of those people, too. That's great.
Yes, well, as a graduate student, I was working in the psychology of language and specifically in how children learn language. But many of the things that I had to do, what my professors were doing and what my friends were doing, had to do with reading as well and how children learn to read. One of the things that was a new issue at the time was that many of the older reading techniques teaching people to read assumed that the eyes sort of glided down the page and that was it. And when you wanted to read faster, you just made sure that you never looked back. But then somebody noticed that a lot of really skilled readers were jumping back occasionally. And that, in fact, your eyes do not glide down the page. They jump from one spot to the next. This is called a saccade, if you want the technical term. And there was a bit of rethinking. Hey, maybe we better find out how skilled readers read before we try to teach the kids anything, because we might be teaching them wrong. So there was a whole band of people that began working on that, and some of the people are the ones that I talk about in Murder, Miss Red. There are two professors. One is Charlie Fielding, who's the guy who has hired Maggie Ryan as a statistical consultant, and the other is Tal Chandler, who is he's emeritus, but he's still very active around the department, which is true of a lot of professors. They can't quite quit when it's time to quit. And he's having a lot of fun, and he and Charlie are on slightly different sides. They both agree in how the eyes move. What they're quarreling about is what determines the place that it lands next. Is it that you have some idea of what the author of the writing wants to is thinking about? Is that what you're doing, or is it just the shape of the word that's coming up? Some have tails below the line and some above the line, and things like that. Is it your peripheral vision will know a rough shape of the word, and then your eye can jump to that. Is that the way it works, or is it because you can predict what the meaning of the word will be, and that's what you need? So this was the very important question that they were dealing with quarreling about. But basically, they were very much on the same side. You wanted to find out how skilled readers read.
That is a very important question. I mean, I've dealt with kids with reading, and a lot of times, it depends. Sometimes they read too fast. They don't hear what they're reading. They just word call. And sometimes they read too slowly because they don't know the vocabulary. And sometimes they can't track because they leave out letters and words, and their spatial relations are bad. And you have to teach them how to do fusion. There's a whole lot. So, yeah, and running records are fantastic because you have to just time them within a minute or so to see how fast they can read and how many words they read, and then you just sort of course out the ones they got wrong to decide how many can read in a minute. I know this because I have to do this with my nephew every night.
I'm getting good at this. Yes, and the time that Murder Misread is set is when they were first beginning to sort of tease these things apart, and so now it gives people like you have the tools when you need them, and I'm sure that they can continue to be improved. So science never quits. you find out an answer, and it just means there's a new question.
I know. The science of reading is fascinating to me. So
it is.
We've got Tal, and he invites everybody to lunch. And what happens that he never makes it?
At first they think he's late and they don't know why. What happens is it's a place very much like Cornell University, although I certainly don't call it that. There are a lot of differences too. Like Cornell, there's a gorge along the side of the campus, and on the other side is the college town. And so Tal picks a college town restaurant to have a celebration. He says there's something he wants to celebrate and invites various department members and Maggie Ryan also, who happens to be there. And she says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I have to have lunch with my kids who are off with daycare." But it turns out that the babysitter is perfectly willing to keep them on, and so she thinks she'll just go along with Charlie Fielding, who's her new boss, or her new coworker, I guess. She's only a consultant. And they will go together to this lunch because she likes Tal very much, the 2 minutes that they talk. So they go across the gorge on the bridge and to the college town. Mm-hmm. She goes off for a minute to mail a letter and comes back, and she and Charlie go into the restaurant and meet the other two people that have come. Bart Bickford is a professor, and Nora Peterson is the other professor. They're looking around saying, "Where's Tal?" And suddenly there's a cry from outside, "Help, help." And Maggie's out like a shot and discovers that a young woman is weeping because she saw a body in the gorge, and it turns out to be Tal. So that's what happens. That's why he doesn't show up at his own celebration.
That's so sad. So we meet Tal's wife, and she is angry. So why does she seem so in control? Her husband is dead, and she doesn't seem to be too upset. Why does she become irate when they claim it was a suicide? They think that he killed himself. And then Maggie teams up with her to try to solve the murder. How come? And why does his wife get... She doesn't seem upset at all. She was the most in-control person I've ever met. Whose husband died.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes. Well. When you get, she's one of the point of view characters. So once you get inside her head, you realize she really is upset. She's got just a touch of Holly Schreiner about her, that she's got she has this deep grief, but her favorite response is to lock it away, keep it back, stay in control of yourself. And thinking about things has always been her answer. She's an academic. She's a professor. And she and Tal got along wonderfully. It was a happy marriage despite a couple of bumps on the road. So she is very, very deeply upset because she knew that Tal was happy. He was going to be celebrating. She was a little bit hurt that she hadn't been asked, and then realized that she was supposed to have a luncheon appointment of her own. And so that was why he hadn't bothered to tell her about this little celebration. She had canceled it because she got worried about him when he didn't answer the phone. But here he was with a gun in his right hand and his head blown out, and so it looked as though it was suicide.
He killed himself.
And she absolutely could not accept that because she knew he was happy, and she believed he was, and could not understand what exactly would cause that. Maggie Ryan, who had seen Tal before, in the 2 minutes that they met, Tal bounces all over the office, and he discovers that Maggie's husband played Cyrano in a play that he had liked very much. And so he leaps up on the chair and starts waving a ruler around, giving Cyrano's famous speeches, just like a swordsman with a little ruler. And Maggie remembers that was in his left hand. So she points this out to the police, and Anne, of course, is delighted. She says, yes, that proves it. That proves it, because the gun was in his right hand, not his left. So it can't be suicide, and she believes that. But the cops, meanwhile, are fighting each other.
That's right.
This has happened right on the borderline. The city cops, Hines, gets there first and begins processing the crime scene. And then the campus cop comes and says, well, you know, this is really on my territory. And the city cop says, well, you know, you're supposed to call us in when it's serious. And that is the agreement between a lot of campus cops and city cops, just so that students don't get in too bad trouble when they're still young and drunk and so forth. So the campus cops are supposed to be a little bit more kindly and political because of the youth of the so many people. But this is a different situation, though. This is a dead body. This is very close to the border line, and the city cops should have been called in. But the campus cop is
that.
Still. Yeah, the campus cop is still.
I have to ask my nephew that. He goes to college. My nephew goes to sleepaway college. I have to ask him about that, because 2 weeks ago I texted him and I go, Josh, how was your week? He said, oh, I have to tell you, we just got locked down. We had a bomb threat. I go, that makes me feel so happy. And he says it happens all the time. And
boy.
And it's a good school. It's an excellent school. It's very safe. And I go, he's somebody. It was must have been one of the students that got a bad grade or something. So
let's talk.
We have about 10 more minutes. So why does Charles Fielding seem on edge when he's questioned? And what is and about the reading project or anything, he seems to be kind of nervous all the time. I like this guy, though. Sorry.
Yes. Well, yeah, Charlie's a sweet little guy. He thinks of himself as Charlie Chaplin sometimes. And I think that was in the back of my head. He's a little bit nervous. We first see him when he enters the story. He's racing along because he's late. His girlfriend has been giving him trouble and won't see him, and so he's been waiting for her in vain. And he goes racing along, and his glasses are bouncing on his nose, and almost runs over Maggie Ryan and her two kids because they've been waiting for him to come and tell him about what her summer job is going to be like. So he's always a little bit on edge, partly because when he talks to Tal, he's actually more comfortable because there's an academic argument that they can have, and they're used to this. But on the other hand, Tal is really so eminent compared to Charlie, who's still starting out. So he feels a little under Tal also. And even the departmental secretary has him spooked a little bit because she controls all of the paperwork and so forth. And so he's a very bright guy, and as you say, he's lovable, but at the same time, he's not a very dominant person. He's short. He's has trouble with women. He's has many things that he would like to have be different in his life, and so I think that it always keeps him a little bit on edge. And and so in anybody that gets up on, well, for example, Cindy observes that his socks are different colors. The departmental secretary, and just this little kind of needling will throw him off balance again. But that's Charlie Fielding, and he is bright. He's doing a very technical kind of an experiment, and so Maggie, who is also has a good technical head, is quite sympathetic to what he's doing and quite intrigued. She insists on taking one of the tests herself, and fails one of the guesses, and so she's very happy and interested in what exactly is going on in reading.
Well, reading is like I love reading. I mean,
yes.
I read 10 books a week. I still do. I read 10 books a week as a kid, and I take notes and everything.
You're my ideal person.
I think everyone should read a lot.
Yes.
I think so. I definitely think so, too. And you know what happens when I got both of your books? I go like, okay, we're just going to sit down and read one. And then I sat down and read the other one. And I'm going like, okay, this is not fair. Like Cheryl knows, because Cheryl's listening. When I don't read the next day after I finish a book, it's because I got eye strain and my eyes bothering. And that's not a good thing for me, but it's a good thing for the author. Doesn't happen too often. So
right.
We have a pack.
Well, I'm honored.
That's delivered. If I didn't read 10 books a week, my mother would say, you know, you're not going out on the weekend. I'm going, yeah, okay, whatever. I did.
Yes, I'm glad you still like it.
You know what? It's funny because when I retired from teaching, my mom had Alzheimer's. And anyone that wants to learn about it, my new book came out last month. It's called The Daughter's Promise. I'm doing a blog tour with Providence Books, which is Cheryl and everybody. And the book is fantastic, and the reviews have been really really nice so far.
Good.
I've given out 150 copies. My doctors all have one. They asked for it.
Good.
People in the restaurant where I go, people at McDonald's, not McDonald's, the Starbucks have it. Everybody's got it. Everybody wants, even the pharmacist in Rite Aid has one. Everybody wants one because everybody has somebody with Alzheimer's. So those of you that don't know, you get a copy of the book because some of the donations and will go to Alzheimer's in memory of my mom, who was a perfectionist to the nth degree, seriously. So we have three more questions. He gets a package. What is mysterious about the package delivered to him?
Well, it's very strange. He didn't order anything, and when he opens it, there's a pornographic magazine, and Charlie is very nervous about this because he knows, you know, he's in the department where a lot of children go through. And he knows how terrible it would be to have any sort of issue like this come up, even though it's primarily adults in the magazine. And so he immediately calls the campus cop and says, what should I do about this? And the campus cop says, I'll pick it up and decide what to tell them. So this is a strange intrusion into his life. He has no idea where it came from. And later they begin to worry that maybe it was some vindictive thing from his wife, who is now on Long Island. But they can't figure out why she would suddenly begin, teasing Charlie from afar this. So it's a mysterious package.
Wait till they find out who did it. We're not going to tell them. Okay, could you define the title? Well, we know Murder and Dog Day. The Dog Days means it's very hot outside. And today, to be exact, everybody, it's 50 degrees. It got hot. It was 48 before when I went out. My kind of weather. And I have kind of friend doesn't put a jacket on, which is not smart, but what the heck. I don't really care. Could you define the title, Murder Misread, and how it relates to the novel?
Yes, it's a. It of course is about reading and about misreading, the mistakes that people make and how that can point you towards the correct answer. That of how skilled readers actually read, because they do make a few mistakes, and that will show you what they're really looking for, whether it's the shape of the word or the meaning of the word. And, of course, it also means that a lot of clues get misread and in this particular book. So that's the reason that I thought that this was a good name for this particular book.
Well, it did, and it caught my attention because I have it on my shelf, and usually there are about 20 people that have hands out. They're not getting it. I may lend them Murder and Dog Days, but the other one, no, they're not getting that because the stuff about reading is important, and I love it.
Good.
So before we end, okay, I have to ask this question. Olivia and Jerry, are you going to bring them back? And what is next for Maggie? Because I like those two characters. Sorry.
Oh, yes. well, the last book in the series that I've planned so far is called Bad Blood. And it's available this month, actually, from Barnes & Noble and you know, all the usual places should have it. In this one, you discovered the answer to some of the questions that you asked that I didn't quite answer in this one, and also about all the other of the seven other books. From the very first one, I was sort of looking towards Bad Blood and the answers about Maggie herself. But in between, you have a number of different point of view characters, like Holly Schreiner and Olivia Kerr, like Anne, the widow, and Charlie Fielding. You see things from their point of view. You never see them from Maggie's. And in the last book, Bad Blood, you finally discover what it is that she's been thinking about, among many, many other things, during the years of, it's about a dozen years that we cover in these eight books. So
okay, so you have this, when is this coming out exactly?
It was out, I think that the very first copy I saw was day before yesterday, so it's out right now. Right this instant.
And they didn't send it to me? And they didn't send it to me yet. How dare they?
No.
Are you doing another blog tour with Cheryl for this one? Are you doing Bad Blood?
No. There's just a blast. That's all. Because I wasn't sure when it was coming out and whether we would have copies for people yet. Maybe in a couple of months we'll reschedule something. But you'll definitely be on the list, Fran. Don't worry.
Don't worry me. I want to be at the top of the list. And Cheryl's listening. Cheryl, just remember that she said I'm going to be at the top of the list because, you know, after all, what can I say?
Okay, great.
I think, you know, it's funny because reading is, I read the classics when I was in third grade. I read Little Women, Little Men, Alice in Wonderland. Yeah, my third grade teacher was fantastic, and she started me off, and I haven't stopped since. I got dared by my sister to do my first book review before she died. I reviewed a cookbook, and I don't know how to cook. And it was such a great review and so funny that everybody had asked me to review books afterwards, and the first author I ever did on my radio show was Tess Gerrinson, and I just interviewed her last month.
Yeah,
and Colin Eggers should be interesting, and I'm interviewing on December 11th D.P. Lyle, who writes for Criminal Minds.
You have so many wonderful things, and I think that you seem to have a touch of Maggie Ryan in you, too, because you're always exploring and going out into the world and asking new questions in new ways. So I think that's great.
Well, I know my husband says to me, why do you keep asking? Well, I was told a long time ago by my sixth grade teacher, don't ask any questions and keep quiet, just listen. And then when I got into the seventh grade, my teacher looked at my mother and said, who is she? And I had 100 average. I was really smart. And he says, who is she? And she had to take out a picture. That was the last time I kept quiet. He said, if she wants to get her 100 average, she better start raising her hand. So before we end, where can we get every one of your books, all seven, and then the eighth one when I get it? Where can we get them, and where can we learn more about you?
My website is www.pmcarlson.net. It's a net and not a com.
Got
so
it.
pmcarlson.net.
And I think everybody, you know, Hanukkah is coming. And right now, as we speak, I am making the show go live so that...
Okay,
computer. My computer is not cooperating, as usual. Yeah, there it is. I'm going to make it go live so that everybody could listen.
Good. I'd like to do that, too.
Yeah, you can. I will email you. I have your email address, so I will email you the link in a couple of minutes or in a couple of seconds as soon as I don't disconnect my computer. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful outside. And, yeah, 37 hours on Thursday. His books are so great because he deals with underwater deep-sea diving, and by the time you get, you know, finished reading the book, and you feel like you're underwater yourself.
Good.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so I have
the
link right here, and I'm going to copy it if I don't mess up my computer. And I want to thank you so very, very much. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope that you do schedule another one with Cheryl and everybody, because they're doing mine, and they are the best. There's nobody better than Partners in Crime.
I agree.
Okay. So everybody have a nice day, and thank you so much. The sun is shining, and go buy some books. Have a nice day, everybody, and bye.
Okay. Goodbye.